trusty money remains the bedrock of stability. The soul of money is trust.
I think we are not paying sufficient attention to the law of unintended consequences.
In the immortal words of the Doors, the time to hesitate is through.
Kiwi, what's going on?
Oh, the same old D. How about yourself?
Very little, man. Just doing the do, getting it done, you know. Trying to push the progression and make today better than yesterday.
Good man. That's what you can only do.
That's it. So how did you discover Bitcoin?
2017. I had always had an appeal towards finding a way to be able to say no. My mum was a professor in Indigenous Studies and Peace Treaties, and my father was a police officer, then private investigator. So my background, in contrast of my mother and father, have very different ideologies. One about sovereignty, the other about rule of law and conformity. And so I always had myself conflicting views about it. But I fundamentally realized that if you don't have the capacity to say no, well, then what does that make you? And so, you know, around those 2010 to 2017, I was coming out of those teenage years, and I think that was the premise for why I had some sort of fatalistic nihilism. I don't want to be like solely blaming on that and not taking any, you know, personal accountability, but I just knew that there was a lot of things wrong. And so any time I had the chance to participate in some form of escapism, I genuinely did, and lived for the weekends, that kind of mentality. So then when 2017 rolled along, I realized how many things this fixed. But the qualm was, and I think this is probably something that you hear quite often, is I thought I had to touch, you know, that there was many new Bitcoins, in the sense that I thought that something was coming out that was better, and, you know, there was a few shit coins that I thought were like the next Bitcoin. So I had to touch that stove and realize that it's Bitcoin, not blockchain. But that's how I sort of came about in the 2017 era. And then it was over the next few years that I really went down the rabbit hole, which I'm really glad that I did. It changed my life.
Was there, I mean, so you mentioned that your mum being a an Indigenous Studies professor and your father being a cop, you've got that kind of, as you said, that internal conflict. And do you think any of that kind of primed you to the tech? I mean, most people come at it from a gains point of view. They see this thing, you know, going parabolic to the moon, and they think that they can make their fame and fortune, or at least their fortune, off the back of it. Did you come in for the gains, or was it more of a deeper philosophical approach?
I think it was more of a deeper philosophical understanding, in the sense that the two are not mutually exclusive. For one to appreciate and gain strength is for the former system to depreciate and lose power. And I kind of understood that from day one. There was just the haze of, well, there's multiple versions. How do you know which one? And so I kind of got lost in that for a while, but I knew fundamentally that this wasn't just for the gains, because if you're coming into it and measuring your gains with the existing system that's supposedly dying, then you're not really grokking it because you're still valuing it in the former.
So you did go down the shitcoin route, though.
I did. Yeah, I thought I thought Power Ledger was going to be the next thing with Jim. Yeah, and she was like, oh, you know, we're talking with Elon Musk and you're going to be able to trade whatever excess energy that you create and it's the next Bitcoin and it's limited by how much energy you can create. And, oh, man, I fell for that like a sucker.
But, I mean, you say that you fell for it like a sucker, but, I mean, a lot of people do. And in 2017, you know, there's not as much information about this thing as there is, say, now. You open an account with an exchange and you're just greeted by a smorgasbord of like shiny tokens, like graphics with cool names and like it's very alluring and appealing. It is, you know, I don't think anyone can really escape that. And then your unit bias, even if you're not aware of what that concept is, but like that just creeps in and you're just like, well, Bitcoin's X amount and Power Ledger's, you know, I could get like 7 Power Ledgers for 1 Bitcoin kind of thing. And you're just like, well, no brainer. I'm just going to buy the Power Ledger. You know, I think that's, you'd have to be working especially pretty hard, you know, to not get caught up in that.
Yeah, you really do have to be doing a lot of due diligence. But I got, you know, 50K plus worth of AUD of Power Ledger.
50K?
Yeah, and dude, it went to nothing. Yeah, so it was a very expensive lesson for me.
Wow,
but expensive. It first went up to 350K, you know what I mean?
So, right.
You think you're a freaking genius for half the time, but then once that cycle – it's like instead of the Austrian business cycle for fiat, it's the Bitcoin halving cycle. Once that kicked into gear, and you're a quarter of the halfway through the next cycle and you have that sort of bear downturn for about a year or so, then all the alts get absolutely crushed. Like Bitcoin may go down 80% or 60% or what have you over the last one. But those alts, man, they go down 99, 100% most of the time. So it's a real expensive lesson to learn because, you know, that's a year's wage for me at the time.
I reckon. I mean, I don't – it's really interesting. Like the whole concept of this pod is to sort of uncover people's genesis story and how they discovered Bitcoin, et cetera. And it's sort of – ideally, if you're a new listener, if you're a person to this space that's relatively nascent and you're not entirely sure what's going on, you're trying to orientate yourself and get a little bit of information. The idea is that sort of these particular stories are reasonably universal, and you can sort of learn from others, whether they be positive outcomes or negative outcomes. And I mean, something like a Power Ledger, I think I can remember back in the day being curious about that because I was sort of always about, you know, conservation of energy and just, you know, that whole like, you know, we don't want to be wasting energy. It's like such a stupid concept now that I thought about it actually. But like the idea of a Power Ledger where you can kind of get discounts maybe on your energy use and so on, it's very appealing. But I don't think I was ever confident enough to dump 50K into something. Did you ride it all the way up?
Yeah.
And so, all the way down?
Yeah, 50K went all the way up. It went down and I was refusing to sell for a loss because I thought that these cycles meant that there was something similar for these altcoins as well, because you got to remember that these were new at the time. And so you kind of look at Bitcoin's cyclical nature and you extrapolate outwards and think that it's applicable to these newer and better, quote unquote, coins and systems. Because not only was it viewed at the time as like a decentralized form of money pegged to electricity creation and usage, but it's like a way to decentralized the power system as well, instead of being from like one or two major nodes in the electrical system to everyone sort of finding ways to create and share energy. But obviously, that's not how it panned out.
No, clearly not. I mean, so for a moment there, you had paper gains and you're on top of the world, right?
Oh, yeah. You're up, you know, what, 350? So you're up like, you know, 700% or so.
Yeah. And did you want more? I mean, your greed kicked in and you were just like, nah, what's going higher? Or, I mean, that's a thing, right?
Yeah. Well, the problem is with shit coins is like there's no such thing as low time preference. The longer you hold it, the more risk you have. You're just not aware of it at the time for some fundamental reasons that you don't quite yet grok.
So it's trading at 17 cents as we record this.
Ooh.
I don't know what time. I don't know what you bought into. I don't know if you want to reveal that, but it's a lesson for everyone that. You know, stay away from the altcoins.
I think it was nearing about $1.80, if I recall correctly, and we got in, you know, just as it was starting, and bought more when it dipped to like, you know, a few cents.
It's a similar tough thing though with like securities and equities and ETFs and stuff as well. I mean, I remember playing penny stocks a few years ago and buying all of those because. Really, you're just trying to make a little bit of money to save for something, and you don't really have a comprehension of actually how money works. I think, I mean, I didn't early doors. I was just thinking, okay, well, I want to save, say, a deposit for a house or something. This seems like a way that I can get there a little bit faster, and it's kind of what you're taught to do. It's like, you know, you've got to put some money in the stock market and see, like, all right, well. Yeah. See what's going on here, and you know you do get the unit bias. You're like blue chips. I'm not buying them. I haven't got that much money. Let's see here. This thing's 5 cents. That looks pretty cool.
You know? Yeah, it is. You know that cost of capital. So the amount of inflation versus the interest rates. And so if inflation's higher than the interest rate that you'd get in your savings account. Then you are incentivized to gamble because you are penalized for savings.
Totally.
And so it's kind of like just completely altered society's like time preference. And now instead of just having the specialization and division of labor, which is just focusing on what you're passionate about and competent in, you kind of have to spend a lot of time looking at like ways to preserve your wealth. And what that does is it takes away from your ability to do what you're good at. And that takes away from, you know, your ability to be more efficient at that and help others more in that area. And so it has really deep impacts. And because like without savings, you know, you don't have that ability to be confident about future security because that's really what savings are. You know, it's just reducing future uncertainty.
Right.
It's having the asset with the most optionality in case, you know, shit does hit the fan. And they put us in what is called like these business cycles, which is where they influence the amount of money in the system and then the interest rates too. So they pump the system full of cash. They lower interest rates, which incentivizes everyone taking debt, making stupid amounts of money by gambling. And then once everyone's over leveraged, inflation's running too high, they start raising the interest rates. And that just means that a lot of people start defaulting because they can no longer pay the debt that they owe. And then you have this cascading set of liquidations. And it's just, it's really sinister when you think about that in and of itself and how it's depicted. Do you know what I mean? Like they say that, they monopolize and debase the currency in the name of stability and that we wouldn't be able to do anything without that. Like it's foul.
Well, it's almost, I mean, when you spell it out like that, it's almost like it's wicked. It's,
it is.
It's like intentionally evil, even if evil is probably maybe an emotive word. Maybe these people aren't necessarily quote-unquote evil, but I mean, when you hear comments that Juicy J made at the end of last year in some panel about, oh, well, we're learning a little bit more about how inflation works, in front of a room of really apparently serious people, you know, they've all got the suit and tie on, and he says an inane comment like that, and you think, wow, you're actually a deeply unserious person, and you're talking to a room full of deeply unserious people, and if you're learning, like I'm kind of learning out loud here, we're all sort of learning out loud, particularly, you know, on this pod, having discussions like this, but if you're the head of the global reserve currency and you're learning out loud the what inflation is, and you have zero comprehension of the pain that you're, like the real world pain that you're causing people, I guess maybe evil is not so much of a stretch, really, if you think about it.
I would say it is objectively evil because you have, you know, August Carstens from the Bank of International Settlements that, you know, saying what a central bank digital currency is, and he says complete control, negative interest rates in real time, siphoning people's wealth, and the ability to censor at will. It's complete control, and that's what they're gunning for. And when you have people like Christine Lagarde calling Bitcoin an escape hatch that needs to be shut off, well, no one calls it an escape hatch if they like don't know that the problem is something that needs to be escaped from. So
true.
You can objectively say that they know what they're doing is evil. It's usury. It's literally what Jesus threw people out of the temple for. And they know that.
And they get paid a lot of money. And we should just mention as well, Christine Lagarde, convicted felon.
Yeah. Yeah, again, gets a promotion.
Lest we forget. But, I mean, this is the thing, right? So they play with the money like it's it's just pulling on levers and hitting it and hoping. And we've been doing it for such a long time. And then I guess this is where everyone gets, if they think about this problem long enough. I mean, just going back to what you're saying before about being compelled effectively into some sort of gambling, whether that be in the stock market or indeed, you know, on altcoins, like you feel compelled to do this because you intuitively recognize that your money in the bank at whatever, you know, I think up until they started raising rates, like I was running 0.4%, you know, and even if you don't have a comprehension of what inflation is, you're just like, how the hell am I supposed to get ahead at 0.4%, you know?
And when they're lying to you about what the inflation rate is, I mean, you look at the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, and the changes that have been made to use that as a measure just to lower it, while the real measure is the M2 money supply year over year, how much money is being entered or taken out of the system. That's the real inflation rate. And so you're just not even using the right measurements to even be able to calculate initially, unless you really start looking into it. And then once you do and you realize inflation rate's really, you know, 20% and upward, and you have a savings rate of less than 1%, then, you know, if you don't make 20% more that year, you're going backwards.
Yeah.
It's it is sinister.
You're going backwards. And I mean, manipulating the money like that and using it as a, I mean, you think about the measurement, you cannot accurately measure any value in the system because it just changes arbitrarily month on month. It's almost like flipping between imperial and metric, and it's just the whims of whatever they feel like on the day or in the weeks leading up to it or whatever. It's like, oh, we're just going to flip to imperial for the next couple of cycles or whatever, and so everyone that was measuring their value in metric has just lost a whole heap because, you know, I don't know how the I'm a metric boy, but like, you know, it just makes no sense to me, the imperial system. You've got like the boiling point over 100 degrees. I don't understand that. Anyway, point is, you can't make a correct calculation on how to conduct your actions because they're just change all the time.
And then you also got to think of like the competition that you're then up against, you're going against institutions that have a close access to the monetary spigot. So they benefit from like the Cantillon effect that I'm sure you've explained multiple times here. But then they also are aware of the business cycles. So they know when it's going to be becoming inflationary or deflationary, and they can navigate that. They're worth trillions of dollars. They have Ivy League graduates. They have all of the tools. And because they're influencing the inflation rate and your savings rate, that's who you have to compete with. So you have to pay them in order to get them to, you know, take risk for you and do savings, or you have to spend an absurd amount of time and try to take all that risk yourself. But either way, you have to take that risk.
Yeah. I mean, this is how sick it is. I was talking to a friend of mine the other week, and he's sort of going down the path of super, and you know, super in Australia is, I guess it's kind of like an IRA, maybe for our US listeners, where you pay a certain amount per quarter into super fund, and then they allocate that capital on your behalf to whatever. And he was saying that he was talking to one of them. He just called them up and was like, "Now, look, if I want you to just buy and hold, you know, a particular equity, can you do that?" And they're like, "No, we don't do that." And he's like, "What do you mean?" And they're like, "Well, we don't just buy and hold. We trade them." And he's like, "Okay, cool. So that's my money, and I can't allocate. All right. So how about capital gains? Do you pay capital gains on the trades that you make, or is there some sort of loophole because of the fact that it's for super?" "No, we pay capital gains." "Right." So like, how are you getting away with this? How does this even make sense? It's my money. I want you to buy this one thing, right? Like, sit on it and don't touch it.
It's as if trusted third parties are security holes.
Oh, it's weird, isn't it, right? Shout out Nick Szabo.
I swear something.
Man, why do you think that you are open and able to discovering Bitcoin?
It's a good question. I think it's a matter of curiosity, intellectual honesty, and those who are either most likely to do the work to understand the basic fundamentals in order to evaluate it, or those most oppressed through high interest rates or censorship or high monetary inflation. Like, those are the people who are going to be forced to speed up that process a lot quicker. Like, for example, Lebanon today debased the currency 90%.
Yeah.
That's insane. You know, everyone took a 90% haircut that was holding that money.
You can say that too. Like, you can say Lebanon just debased the currency 90%. What that actually means is that yesterday, you know, you had whatever savings you had in the bank, or even holding it as cash underneath the mattress. And then you wake up 24 hours later and you can buy 90% less things with that same amount of money, whether it's in the bank or underneath your mattress, because they just decreed that, which is the essence of fiat. Fiat means by decree. So it's like, how are you supposed to economically calculate a life when they can just do that?
Yeah, and it's all in the name of stability too.
What if, like, you're waking up that morning and you're like, "You know what, today's the day I'm getting my keys to the house that I've just bought, or I'm going to buy this car," whatever it is, man, that you've been saving up for, working, time and energy, and then, yeah, it's worth 90% less. You're going to have to go and find 90% more money now. What?
Yeah, you can only buy 10% what you could have. You can maybe get the garage.
Like, what?
I said you can only buy 10% of what you were going to initially, well, so maybe you can buy just the garage.
Exactly. You know what I mean? But it's like, sorry, how does that work again? Can you explain to me the processes that have led to me not being able to afford the thing that I've spent the time and energy saving up for? I'm very confused right now.
Yeah, and like, what really grinds my gears with it was, like, the fact that there's no consent involved, right? They, as soon as they monopolized the money, they had the means to, you know, monopolize the legal system, the educational system, to back it with the threat of violence because they now have unlimited money. It's just like that first domino to fall is when you start, you know, going through the stages of the fourth turning. As soon as that happens, you're starting to get into like the second stage, and those other dominoes start to fall, and it's a matter of time. But like the thing that really bugs me about it is like there's no consent involved. But if you're wanting to be like, okay, I want to opt out of the system, I want to be a Bitcoiner because like it's a voluntary system that can't be debased or censored, and that is viewed as like toxic extremity, whereas by default, you know, violently enforced involuntary contracts debased and monopolized in the name of stability, like that is deemed normal. Like it's just so backward.
The whole concept of voluntarism can be understood by like a two-year-old, right? They understand that if they want to engage in play, that they've got to do it voluntarily, like that. And if they don't want to do it, they don't do it. It's pretty straightforward. Like they have a tantrum, they walk away, they, you know, do all of these sorts of things. And yet for some reason, your brain, and like this is all actually reinforced when you're a child. And then for some reason you go through education systems or whatever, and it just becomes calcified that coercion, which is the opposite end of that spectrum, is normal. You know, there's a really great essay. I'm just trying to think of the name of the guy who wrote it, but he sort of does away with the left and right dichotomies and concentrates on either voluntarism or coercion, and they're the two spectrums that you should be operating in, not left and right.
It sounds like Democracy, the God That Failed Us by Hans Hermann Hoppe. Sounds like the TLDR of that book.
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting through actually that at the moment. It's here it is. It's Donald J. Baudreau, Coercivists and Voluntarists. And yeah, it's a short, sharp essay on effectively that spectrum. So the left and right is useless. That's the two wings of the same crappy bird, and the two spectrums are actually you opt in or you opt out, and you have optionality at all times. And that's the thing, right?
But isn't it?
You're coerced into it.
Yeah. And that's so relevant to other categories. But like we say, you know, rape is bad, consent is needed, sex is good. We say that, you know, my body, my choice. But then when it came to like the vaccines and stuff, that was no longer applicable. So it's just weird how we take these different circumstances and decide whether or not consent as a premise is valued or should be required, where it seems to me like that should be a universal principle and that there could be no justification for the absence of it.
And the thing is, happens in such a subtle way. You're effectively coerced to use this particular form of money that can be debased by 90% overnight.
What we saw with the truckers in Canada, you know, we had mums that were donating as little as $5 to the truckers because they believed in their cause of bodily autonomy, you know, requiring consent. And just because they donated that amount of money, $5, like they had their bank account frozen.
Yeah, and were labeled terrorists.
Exactly right. So it's just funny how that switch can just be turned or off depending on, you know, the politics of the time.
Yeah, and I mean, because you're so distracted by life, really, I mean, no one has time for thinking about most of this shit. And to be honest, like, I think there's a massive majority of people that are just like, they just don't really think about this stuff. Not because that's too difficult or whatever. It's just, there's a whole bunch of people that like go along to get along. And I think they're not as numerous as like a bigger majority that are just like, yeah, I'm not doing that. But when push, like when push comes to shove, they'll, you know, they'll donate the $5 to support whatever it is. But they won't. They won't necessarily. God, where am I going with this?
I think that that cognitive dissonance is sort of born out of fear of not fitting into the group, and also fear of, like, once you start asking yourself some of those fundamental questions, then there's no real going back. Do you know what I mean? You can't just take the blue pill and just go back and be like, la-di-da, nothing matters. Yeah. You know, just back to not caring about these things. Like, once you start to question it, then you have to sort of question everything that you've sort of built your own identity from. And that can be really confronting for a lot of people. So I think it's just like conformity out of comfortability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly it. That's where I was going. I mean, that's the thing. And that's kind of what Bitcoin enables you to do, is to, it almost gives you a bit of leverage to start questioning, because, as you said before, savings is a tool, a technology that allows you to mitigate future uncertainty. And so then you can sort of free up a little bit of time and energy to investigate things that you're curious about. And that could be, yeah, the differences between coercion and voluntarism, or why does a money debase by 90% overnight arbitrarily, or who are these 12 people in a room making decisions about interest rates once a month? Like, what's that about?
Or if they can just print money and have an infinite amount, why do I pay taxes?
100%, particularly when the vast majority of that coin that is taken from you gets spent in areas that you may not necessarily agree with, and there's no receipt, you know.
Especially when it's taken so many ways, you know, like, oh, you worked, okay, income tax. Oh, you're holding on to your money, okay, inflation. Oh, you want to spend, goods and services tax, you know, tax for it being gas, or, you know, oh, you died, okay, inheritance tax. Like, it's just any action that you do, it's just tax out the ass. And so, like, it's just, it's so bizarre, especially being in the States, because, you know, you look at the American history and, like, the Boston Tea Party, where they're like, you know what, we're not paying your stupid 1-2% tax over tea.
Yeah.
Go shove it. You know, we're going to dump it in the harbor. And if you want war, like, come bring it. Don't tread on me. And so now you turn around, though, and it's like, once you add all the different taxes, it's like above 50% of, you know, of all of your, the money that you earn is going and funding things like, you know, sending trillions of dollars to Ukraine, or funding the state apparatus so they can implement mandatory vaccines, or mass, you know, never-ending wars in the Middle East. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, 20 years of effectively, you know, outright warfare in the Middle East, and then they walk away saying, oops, we lost that, and leave, what was it, $80 billion worth of equipment behind as well?
I think it was more than that.
You know what I'm saying?
I think it was like 0.7 trillion, yeah. It was an absurd amount.
You know, and you effectively allowed for that by paying for it. I mean, regardless of whether it was voluntary or not, I mean, you actively paid for all of that. And it's just like this, yeah, rules for thee and not for me type garbage that we really need to get out from under. And that's, I guess, why Bitcoin does attract a lot of individually minded, freedom orientated, thoughtful, curious individuals. And, you know, when you say those sorts of things like individually minded, freedom orientated, a lot of people that haven't thought about it deeply enough will automatically think you're some right-wing nutbag, but it couldn't actually be further from the truth. The Bitcoiners that I know are some of the most generous, thoughtful, heartfelt people I think I've ever met in my life. And like, it's the complete antithesis of what you would think. All they want to do is just be left alone to just get on with their day, you know, and not have all of their money taken from them violently.
Yeah.
Or with the threat of violence.
It's as if like, all they want is just consent as a prerequisite. And for that to be framed as like violence or extremism is just the most absurd thing that I think I've ever heard. And all they want to do is just like to voluntarily give a product or service to their wider community, and in turn be able to give more to their family. Like it's what it's all about,
right?
Is giving to society so you can give more to your family. Like that's all they want to do, and they want consent to be a premise of that, because otherwise, it's slavery.
Yeah,
if you can't say no.
It's not a radical thing at all. It's basically in a children's book. There's a favorite in our household, which is Richard Scarry's What Do People Do All Day? And it's just effectively a really high-level view of a town, the busy town, and it's just people working, and it sort of dives into how people make a crust and cooperate and build a life and, you know, spend their time and energy on the things that they are good at or they like to do, like their family, etc. I mean, it's written in like the 60s or something.
You're just talking about savings and the specialization and division of labor there.
Division of labor, I know, right? Radical.
Yeah. Yeah, extreme. But you also had, some of the old school cartoons like Robin Hood. It's like he wasn't stealing from the rich to give to the poor. He was taking back what was involuntarily and violently taken from innocent people and giving it back to them. But it's just so funny how those things are then framed later down the road and how those narratives transform. But like, if you think about the premise, like violently stolen and then someone comes and takes that and gives it back, and he's like the cherished, you know, hoodlum that does that. Yeah. And there's a good reason why he was depicted as a hero in that cartoon. And that's because, you know, involuntary contracts violently enforced is a heinous and insidious act.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just gets twisted over time. And then eventually, you know, if a generation goes by and it's not iterated upon, it just gets forgotten. So, I'm wondering, with Bitcoin, how has it changed you? How has discovering Bitcoin changed you?
Okay. It's a great question. I could talk for hours about it, so I'll try to be concise. I think I already mentioned before that I knew with the absence of consent as a premise that I was, you know, dealing with a lot of escapism and living for the weekends, and knew that the system was kind of messed up. So just having a very high time preference, not really valuing my future, but just trying to live as much now and with that short-sightedness as I could. Mm-hmm. But then you realize there's a mechanism where consent is a prerequisite, where you can have savings that aren't debased or aren't censored. And so then you start thinking, instead of, you know, days or weeks or weekends, you start thinking of years and decades and intergenerational. And so the decisions that you start making are no longer like, you know, what's going to benefit me as much as possible in the near term. It's like setting up a foundation for not only you and your family, but for your, you know, future children that are to come. So it's like you just start living a very different life. It's no longer looking forward to weekends to finish things up. It's like you're excited to be contributing to something you're passionate about. You've found your tribe. You've found the group that you identify with and other people agree with. You start having all of these awesome Socratic conversations and you're intellectually honest enough to change your mind, but you're having these wide-ranging conversations now, and it's just like all of these things that you kind of wish you had when you were having that high time preference life. It's like you wish you had those deeper connections. You wish you woke up on Monday morning and were excited to get going. You wish that you were planning something for like intergenerational wealth and thinking about a legacy rather than the next paycheck and, you know, what favorite drink is. it changes everything.
And what is it about Bitcoin, though, that enables you to have that longer-term view, you know? Because at the end of the day, I mean, for people listening, they might just think, well, yeah, but isn't it just for the gains? I don't know. Maybe that is.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, but what's compelling you? What is it about Bitcoin that compels you to stay, maybe I should be thinking a little bit longer term here?
For sure. I think there is the hero's journey, which you're obviously having these podcasts for, is to, you know, entice people to explain their hero's journey.
Mm-hmm.
But how does it change it? It's like, well, rather than me not being able to have a vehicle for savings, rather than me not being able to say no to involuntary and violent taxes and debasement and censorship, I can have savings. I can say no. And we can all do that en masse, and there's no way for that to be stopped. So rather than it being like viewed as gains that you're eventually going to cash out of, it's actually viewed as like a better system that's replacing the old one because it's the most saleable, or it's just the better network and the better money. So it's like, well, why would I, you know, wait until it's X many dollars per coin more than it is now just to sell out and go back into the old system where I couldn't say no to debasement, to censorship, to all the different taxes where consent wasn't valued? Like, there's no amount of money in that older system that would make me go backwards when I could just spend the current, you know, the current one at those prices and then continue saving in it. Like, once that clicks, there's just no going back.
It is a one-way street. There's no doubt.
Like, yeah, the genius out of the bottle.
Yeah, you're not crossing that bridge to go back over. It's kind of like, I don't know who said it. I think it may have been Wicked Smart Bitcoin, but like when they first discovered gold, and let's say you got down to your local community or something, and you're talking about these gold bars that you discover, these gold nuggets, whatever. And everyone's like, oh, cool, I'll get some of those. And then they sell the top and for more seashells that was used as the currency, something like that. You know, if the money was seashells, yeah. And it would be like, yeah, stacking a whole bunch of gold and then selling the top for more seashells. It's like, it's just shitty money, man. Like,
yeah,
you can't go back. And then
I think another apt metaphor from I think it's Ron Paul. He's like, well, when you take cancer out of your body, what do you replace it with? And it's, you don't replace it with anything. You're better. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to put the poison back in just because you took one out.
Yeah, that's it, man. And I mean, it enables you to do that. So, like, going back to sort of the Lebanon event that's happened recently, that can't happen with Bitcoin. And so, if you even had an inkling that they could arbitrarily debase it, not even by 90%, let's just say conservatively 10-15%, you're still effectively compelled to get rid of that money as quickly as you possibly can, because it might debase 10% tomorrow, 15% the next day, whatever. And so you don't want to hold on to it. It's like a hot potato. You want to go and buy some stuff with it. And then that then incentivizes the production of stuff produced at a high velocity, and then you get all of this trash and plastic and other sorts of crappy product that is purposefully created to meet the demand of this money that's that you're compelled to spend, I guess. And so then you get things like consumerism and stuff where, you know, there's people, I guess, typically on the left-hand side of politics, which decry consumerism, and they confuse it with capitalism, and how capitalism's constantly causing people to consume mindless amounts of garbage, whatever that is, when it's actually, no, it's just because at any moment your money is just going to be worthless, and so you're an idiot if you hold on to it for any length of time.
Yeah, that's one of those things that really grinds my gears, is the misuse of that terminology when they talk about capitalism, because when you look up the definition of capitalism, it's just voluntary interaction in free markets, essentially. And so what are free markets? Well, that means the money is not monopolized, debased, and censored. Like, there's no such thing as crony capitalism, because there's no such thing as crony free markets. Either they're free or they're not. It's binary. And so that's what really peeves me off when you have, you know, people like Tom Luongo being like, oh, we got to back the Federal Reserve, otherwise these World Economic Forum nuts are going to ruin American capitalism. It's like, you don't have capitalism under the Fed. It's like, oh, it's hard to even have a conversation when the terminology starts getting twisted. And particularly in Lebanon, where it's like you start having these, you know, intellectuals, fiat intellectuals like Nassim Taleb. He wrote the foreword for Saifedean's Bitcoin Standard. And you know what he told the people in Lebanon? He said, buy wineries and olive oil and stuff like that. Oh, yeah, that's going to save you from a 90% haircut. Like, it's just the most stupid. And even then, like, you're still going to have to use money to buy things or barter. Like, just by having savings of olive oil, it's like the most absurd solution. So it's like all these people that just get captured in academia. And then eventually, in order to have their work continually published, or in order for them to get the megaphone from the controlled media, it's like, they have to conform to these narratives.
They're useful idiots, kind of.
Exactly.
I think Taleb actually calls them intellectual yet idiot or something, which is pretty ironic given his statements about olive oil as a store of value, which it probably is relative to the whatever the name of the currency is in Lebanon. But, I mean, good luck trying to liquidate that in a monetary sense. I mean, you could pour it out.
Yeah, good luck trying to go down to the store and buy stuff with olive oil and port that round, or good luck trying to buy something over the internet with a few thousand liters of olive oil.
Right. It's like when oil was like sub a dollar a barrel in like 2020. And you know, it's you could buy a whole heap of it, but like you still got to store it somewhere and then sell it for, you got to find a buyer. I mean, that's why money is the most marketable or saleable good, right?
Yep. Carstens made an absolute killing when that happened from the Bank of International Settlements. The guy who looked like he ate three other guys. He made an absolute fortune when that happened.
He features in the intro to this song, actually, to this pod, our boy Carstens. He's like the big boss in Spider-Man. What's the guy's name? I can't remember.
he ate the Hamburglar from McDonald's.
Oh, dude. Like, I mean, the fact that he even has opinions that are worth listening to, given the state of him. I mean, I'm not, I just think like you, whatever you say is irrelevant. You're just a very unimpressive human being. And so, like, I don't care what all your theories say. Go and eat some steaks, bro, 100%. And have a couple of sessions at the gym, and then let me know your thoughts on monetary policy. I might entertain that, you know.
For sure.
It's nuts.
I think, though, in regards to, like, how it changes you, like, once you start going down these rabbit holes, you start finding, like, these adjacent rabbit holes as well that have similar themes woven throughout. So, like, some could be, like, 3D printing or, you know, drones or platforms like Noster or self-hosting your own instances for messaging and stuff like that. Like, there's all of this tech makes me just like incredibly optimistic. And this is in the face of everyone being like, we have the WEF Agenda 2030 social credit system. It's inevitable. Mm-hmm. There's no escape. And then, like, as soon as you start going down this rabbit hole, and you can see, no to one thing, you start realizing how much stuff you can actually say no to and how much power you really have. And so that really influences how you, you know, your outlook on life and your ability to be accountable and responsible moving forward. Your ability to navigate to a future that you kind of want to see and work towards it and help others do the same. Like, it's just the complete opposite of how I was prior to finding this.
That's quite an incredible journey. It's 180, really. I mean, you talk about being self-interested, right, and selfish, maybe, you know, living for the weekend. What can I get out of this? This is blah, blah, blah. And everyone says...
I actually dislike that word selfish as well, because everyone's always acting in their own self-interest.
Precisely.
All the time. It's just a matter of, like, are they aware of the fact that you have to give in order to receive, rather than selfish being like, thinking you have a claim to someone else's labor or something like that. Like, I don't think selfish is the apt word for that.
No, it's like, but I guess what I was saying is you're regarded as being selfish, or maybe you regard yourself, if you're in your quieter moments, as being selfish, but you can be self-interested by directing your energies to the betterment and the improvement of yourself, which then has a net benefit effect to those around you, whether that's your immediate family, your community, your friends, etc. So acting in your own self-interest is fundamentally being human being. It's just that the only reason I'm doing this podcast is because it's interesting to me. And it just happens to align with you for the moment, where, you know, you're self-interested enough to share that time and energy with me. But then it sort of is a net benefit. But if I was being selfish, I might just not do anything, not contribute anything, and just be consuming everything today instead of trying to contribute, but, you know.
Is that selfish, or is that just...
Yeah,
I don't know better word than retarded, because, like,
highly regarded.
Highly regarded. If you're not trying to offer a product or a service to the wider community, whether that be domestic or international, then you're not going to be able to have savings, which reduces future certainty, and you're going to have to eventually lower your standard of living. So I don't know if selfish. Like, anyway, that's just my OCD.
Yeah, no, I get it, man. It's there's tons of nuance to unpack. I guess I always come back to this Jurassic 5 track called Contribution, and it's literally the chorus. Either you're a part of the problem or you're a part of the solution. What's your contribution to life? And I think that is kind of like a bit of a North Star for me, in terms of, you know, am I contributing to the problem here, and I'm making things worse, or am I actually trying to actively make things better for myself, my family, friends, the community, etc.? Like, what am I contributing to life? And you know, if I'm self-interested, I like to think that I'm contributing something positive. If I'm selfish, I'm probably part of the problem. If you see what I'm saying, like, there's a very fine line of nuance there.
Yeah. And I think that's one of those things where it's like your understanding of, like, economics, and, you know, economics just being describing human action and how they interact, not like some prescribed mathematical formula for how people interact, which is absurd. But once you start understanding economics, and, you know, voluntarism and Bitcoin and stuff, and so it's like it sends you down the hero's journey, and it's called the hero's journey because even though it may be never ending, at the end, the closer you get to that end of the spectrum, you're just more of a hero and you're just a better person the further down you go. And I think it was like 2020, I was in Hawaii and COVID had just dropped. You know, the thing back then was like, Bitcoiners were doing what's called an ikigai. Do you know what it is?
It's like a Venn diagram. Is that right?
Yeah. And it's just like what you're good at, what you like doing, what you think the world needs, and what you could get paid for. And it just aligns your passions and interests and gives you a clearer, you know, description of the path you should head towards.
Right.
And so that was the popular thing. And now the popular thing is like, I'm not drinking. I'm gymming more. It's always oriented around proof of work and just, you know, doing better. It's like such a marvelous community to be around. And it's so funny that it's like depicted as like toxic hostility, because it's just like the furthest thing from the truth.
No, it's just the toxic hostility just comes from an inability to tolerate bullshit, really. It's just like, oh man, like just go to the gym if you want to get fit, eat healthy if you want to like get a little bit healthier. You know, put some effort into thinking about these things, researching them, finding out, being curious. And if you're not curious, then like you're not going to make it. Sorry. That's all it is. It's just brutal honesty.
They call out the grifters, and they call out the people who virtue signal, but they do so in a manner, initially, in a manner that just like a Socratic style. But then once it's been done a few thousand times, then it just ends in like someone dropping an H, then an F, and then an S, then a P. And it becomes like funny, but like if people are genuinely curious and show some intellectual rigor and honesty, then they're actually met with like these deeply nuanced conversations. But if it's just so confidently wrong, then it's just met with the same level of absurdity back. It's hilarious.
It always comes from a place of compassion and love in terms of trying to orange pill people and shilling them and talking to them about it. And once they show like a Peter Zeihan style mentality, where they're, as you say, they're just so confident, overconfident in their appraisal of this thing, that you just like, everything you're saying is wrong. I can't entertain this conversation anymore. I'm going to do something else, you know, because we understand the scarcity of time and energy.
Yeah. And if you had any intellectual honesty and took these ideas online and actually read some people's comments, and, you know, even if they're quote unquote the respected people, I'm sure you'll still come across a few that would objectively point out your flaws within, you know, the first 10, 20 minutes of that post being up. But then he's talking about it as if it's an absolute. And this absolutism alongside this egotism is just like, so that's what's met with
that's toxic. That's toxic, man. That is toxic, because that doesn't contribute anything. That's contributing to the problem. And the humility to recognize that you might not have the full clear picture here, or that there are elements of this thing that you might find curious, interesting, want to learn, etc. Yeah, but the absolutism is like, it's just arrogance, man. It's just pure ego, really. Yeah. It's just pure ego.
And it's funny as well, because it doesn't just stop at like the economic realm, in the sense that it's not just when we're talking about finances or savings or what have you. When the whole COVID thing was going on as well, when we were trying to decipher risk reward ratios and different trade-offs, and actually applying the scientific method, which is just skepticism until being probabilistically, you know, convinced otherwise. Mm-hmm. And so like that was like some of the funniest part, is when people are like, no, you got to trust the science, and you know, 99% of scientists agree, because you know, 40% of them are censored. It was just like, it was hilarious. But the approach was always the same, is like, you got to come at it from an angle of, here's what I think, here's why I think it. I'm open to being wrong, and I'd be happy to be proven wrong, because it would save me a lot of time.
Right on.
Yeah. And it, like, that's just so applicable to all of these other sectors and fields of knowledge, that it's just like, you now have this group of people who apply this lens to so many different areas, and they all coalesce around the same monetary system, and it's just emanating outward, and it's just going to continue doing so brighter and brighter. It's freaking awesome.
It's pretty damn cool. Well, speaking of knowledge and learning paths and following that curiosity. What have you learned about the world and about yourself since discovering Bitcoin?
Okay. I have learned the things that really matter, and not things you can buy. I have learned that it's about what you can give, not what you can take. The more you give, the better your living standards are, the better you're able to provide for your family, and the better you are able to create a meaningful legacy. And the better you are at doing those things, the better chances your progeny have. And so I think we live at just like this amazing time where it's so early in this like enlightenment or renaissance that it's like we don't even realize that we are the ones that, you know, future books and art will be depicted about. You know, like it's just this incredible time where it's this magic internet funny money that really just changed everything. And so those who are in close proximity to it now don't even realize the importance of it or the influence it will have and how that will be depicted by generations, decades or centuries from now. And that just changes it. That changes everything you do. That changes the intensity. That changes your time preference. That changes how passionate you are about it all. How humble you are about it all. Like, how cool is it that we all get to participate in this ability to voluntarily interact with one another and say no to violence, know that you're in the right, and yet be depicted as so wrong, but you're so peaceful. And like, it's just, it's so it's so absurd that it's kind of funny. And that's how it'll be remembered too, because like there's no way that the central bank digital currency panopticon centrally planned bugs, crickets, pods in terms of incentives and what people want. There's no way that that is what wins out over time. So in order for like us to win, we all get to participate in this just like awesome community that are just building awesome products and services and just accumulating and have done the proof of work to understand proof of work early. And we get to build these amazing legacies and tools that people will use for a long time to come.
It's pretty special when you think about it. When you put it like that, man, like, so many people contributing to the betterment of the world in this space as opposed to being all nihilistic and existential about the whole thing and just giving up effectively. And it's kind of like in Independence Day, there's that scene with Jeff Goldblum when the aliens first arrive and he just sort of starts trashing the office because it doesn't matter, you know, he doesn't care. And there's a whole bunch of people in the world that are like that. They just see the constant stream of noise coming in on their TV and their radio, whatever it is they're getting their quote-unquote news from. And it does leave you with a feeling of despair and hopelessness. And then on the in this tiny little orange corner of the world, there's all of these people running about, having conversations, building, thinking, creating, testing, iterating, writing, coding, all of this stuff to create tools, products, services that, yeah, are fundamentally going to change the world and make it a better place to be.
I think that's depicted in quite a few movies. You know, you have what is that movie where they're in that augmented reality or virtual reality system, that gamer movie we've got on the headset?
Ready Player One.
Yeah. I mean, the whole system's rigged against them. They're living in pods. They're poor. They're escapists where they get to go into the system, but then they all, you know, figure out this game together, work collectively, but in their own best interest, and in the end win and restore, you know, some sort of like winning solution for them all. Or it's like Moana, you know, that child's movie where Maui takes the heart for himself. And then, like, in my view, that heart is like them taking the printing press and disregarding consent. And then you watch this cancer just spread outward. But it's not until someone comes along and finds a solution, whether or not that's fate or destiny or neither, they create the solution to fix that problem and restore that heart. You know what I mean? Like it's prevalent in so many movies these days. I just don't think many grok the analogy.
It's a timeless tale, and it's really all about balance and harmony, right, in the universe. And that's, I fundamentally believe that the universe is about balance at different scales, really. I mean, it depends on what you're considering at the time, but balance is the key, harmony is the key. And when the harmony is, you know, discordant, as it were, then it's not very pleasant to listen to. And if you know, hit two off notes on a piano or something, but then you hit the two right notes and they're in harmony together and they produce a nice sound. You know, we all intuit that, and that's manifested in all sorts of stories and songs and artworks and so on and so forth. And I think Bitcoin and the people working on the betterment of this technology to create a better future is that restoration of balance and harmony in the world, while all of this nihilistic bullshit and noise, that's a signal that's sort of pulsing quietly at the moment. And more people are picking up on that signal each day. You know, it just takes time.
It's like, I don't know if toroidal is the right word, but it's like these different cycles that happen, whether it's like the long-term or short-term debt cycle, whether it's like, well, that is the business cycle. And then you have like these technological cycles where it's like every 60 to 70, 80 years, it's like a technological breakthrough, which leads to like the next industrial age. And I think that this is what triggers like that next industrial age. And it's just, it's freaking cool to grok that relatively early on, like as you would have read in The Sovereign Individual and, you know, Fourth Turning and stuff like that, how it just changes that, it minimizes the return on violence for the time being. And that leads to individual prosperity and like a decentralizing factor, because that is also the cyclical nature where it's like, you know, decentralizing and then centralizing, or as depicted in The Fourth Turning, it's like good times create weak men create hard times create strong men create good times. When those strong men are creating good times, that is the decentralizing part of that cycle. That is where people have found the tools to minimize the return on violence, to be able to say no. Like, it's when they've finally got the ability to have a spine and be like, yeah, no, we're not paying you 2% tax on that tea. We're not doing involuntary contracts. You're not monopolizing, debasing our life force and what we spend our time and energy working on. How about no, Scott?
It's a huge, powerful word. You know, no.
Yeah.
It's remarkable actually to watch a child learn that word, because all of a sudden they've figured out a boundary, whether they've heard it for the first time, because you've said no, you can't do that. You've introduced restriction into their life somehow, like whereas before it was boundless. And it's interesting to watch them comprehend or start to grok the word no. But then on the opposite side of that, you know, trade, it's when they figure out how to use the word no, because then that's powerful for them. And it's quite something to watch, man, like I must say.
Yeah. And then the rest of your life, you're working out that dynamic of who's able to say no and why.
Right on. And is it justified? Is it ethical? Is it moral? Is it all of these things? And even if, is it voluntary? That's the thing. Is it voluntary? And, it's,
you cannot argue against consent being a prerequisite. You can't say,
yeah, you can't.
You know, you shouldn't be able to say no to X because of Y. Like, it's just an inherently flawed objection that has never resulted in anything positive.
That's exactly right. How do you explain Bitcoin?
How do I explain it?
Yeah.
Well, you got to meet them at their level, right? Because if you start explaining it from like a technical perspective to someone technologically illiterate, it's going to make no sense. If you start explaining it economically to someone who's economically inept, it's not going to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of go down like the does consent matter? The inevitable answer is yes. Maybe they give some objections, but you can objection handle that pretty easy. So does consent matter? Yes. Does money matter? The obvious answer is yes. Why does money matter? You can have some brief conversations about savings and time preference or price signals and resource allocation or, you know, the specialization and division of labor, overcoming double coincidence of wants. And then you go into what is money, and that's just anything two parties agree on. What is currency? It's just the most saleable, the most widely used money. So you've kind of come to the conclusion, you know what, why consent's important, you know why money is important, the most important tool. You now know what it is, and then you get into why is Bitcoin important? And Bitcoin's just important for the same reasons we just previously outlined. It's important to be able to say no. It's important to overcome the double coincidence of wants. It's important to have savings and specialization and division of labor. It's important to be able to send that over distance and be able to verify the total supply so that you don't have to have these third parties that you have to trust, even though they have always debased and censored, but you're meant to trust them not to. And that's the root problem, as Satoshi, you know, outlined. And then you go into what is Bitcoin? And that's relatively straightforward. It's just the best form of money. And it is limited because it has a decentralized number of nodes who have all come into consensus of the rules. And you can change those rules, but then you have a different network and no one's going to back that. And so it then, like, the following question is, like, if you know all of those things, what is the most valuable thing you can do with your time? And, like, that's the fun part of the hero's journey.
Totally.
What do you think? How do you go about it?
I'm at a point now where I've sort of stopped trying to lead the horse to the water, and just rather be me and be demonstrative by my own, I don't know, being, I guess, like
leading by example.
Yeah, however someone wants to define success or failure or whatever, you kind of want to be, I mean, John Vallis said this on an earlier pod, like you kind of have to be a fairly impressive person. That the person has to be somehow impressed by you, not in a sort of superficial way, but sort of like, well, you know, that person's doing, he must be doing something right. You know, he seems to be fairly well balanced. He's got a good family, all of these things. Yeah. And I don't know, what's the secret sauce? You know, whereas, because I've just wasted so many sats, and I wouldn't say wasted, but I mean, I guess if the wallets are never spun up again. But my point is that, like, I've given away books and I've given away sats and I've talked about it like a crazy person, and it's generally,
I think everyone does.
Yeah.
Everyone does that along the hero's journey. And then they kind of realize that a sire's job is what is important, and focusing on the remnant that get it and furthering their education because they're actually inclined and passionate to learn more, rather than, as you said, just wasting time and trying to preach to people that just aren't interested in helping themselves or aren't intellectually curious or honest. And speaking of impressive people, like, man, John Vellis, especially in regards to what I just said, like, name someone more impressive when it comes to that.
You know what I mean? Like, he's just a dude. He's a gentleman. He's a gentleman.
Yeah. He is a genuine gentleman. He's jacked. He's doing meaningful work. He has some of the best conversations to listen to. And if you engage with him, like, in a positive manner, or sometimes even in, like, a negative and abrupt manner, like, he takes time to, like, to interact with everyone. It doesn't matter the size of followers they have. It matters what they say. And so he's just, like, a genuine dude. Like, when it comes to, like, people like that, there's very few people like that. And that I've found that they all tend to be Bitcoiners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's I'm going to have to edit this out because I always fucking forget this goddamn video. It's Konza posted it, like, on his thing.
Konza's awesome.
Leonard Reed. One light.
Something. Are you looking for a picture of the business cycles? Is that what you're looking for?
No, it's a light in the dark, like your. God damn it!
Because I just sent you in Keep. I just sent you a picture that I got from Konza, and it's the business cycle in one picture, and it's just so phenomenal.
He's just like got all of the He just has it at his fingertips. I just can't.
Yeah, all the quotes. He knows all of the arguments and the different nuances of how to overcome an objection, handle them, the different points you have to make in order to substantiate that claim. He's got it all just like that.
Man, I wish I could remember that. I just might not mention it. I'll try and find it and I'll send it to you.
He doesn't even have to remember it. He's just got it on his blogs. He's thought about it all in a coherent chronological order, and he's just written it down as he's gone along, which I think more of us should do.
Yeah, I just rely that's why on I kind of like what you Telegram search and just try and write like the right, try and find the right thing.
Well, you saw my Figma file, right? That's just me mapping it out as I go along.
Yeah, I love that. It's just, I really need to write that down and have that because I reference it so many times on the pod and then I'm like, oh, I can't remember the name of it. And it's like, bro, just remember the fucking name of it. We won't even go there. I'll ask you one last question and we'll wrap up. Right. I've been asking this lately. How much is enough?
You're saying how much Bitcoin is enough?
Maybe.
How much giving is enough? Can you have an upper bound on how much you should give?
I don't think so. If your energy is infinite, you just got to generate more and more. I mean, your time is finite, but...
Yeah. If you're able to give, why wouldn't you?
Exactly. If you're able to give, why wouldn't you? Give it away.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to be giving it away. Like, you can give your time, your product or service. You can earn money for it, but you're still giving. Right. You know what I mean? You can give it at a discount if you're in a financial position to help the less fortunate. You can, you know, accumulate capital and deploy it somewhere to help other people. But you're always giving. And if you can give, why wouldn't you? So I don't think there's any upper bound to answer your question.
Well, then how much Bitcoin is enough then? How about that? A bit more definitive.
Enough for what?
I love it. I love it. That's awesome. It's a very subjective question. And, you know, I guess everyone's going to have a scale. But like, as you say, just give your time, give your energy.
Because you can have enough Bitcoin to be like self-sufficient, but then, you know, are you really just wanting that's it, that's your life done, you're bowing out, you don't want to give any more to other people. Like, don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with giving enough where you can retire and just live the life you like doing, but you're still going to want to do something. And it only makes sense, generally speaking, if it's profitable, if it means you're not wasting resources.
There's a lot of wasted resources at the moment in this fiat system, man. It's crazy.
Yeah, there is, but it's kind of irrelevant at this moment. Like, it was becoming increasingly more irrelevant and absurd. And like, the closer we get to that system failing, like, the more absurd it will become. But like, the more apparent its doom will become. And you know what I mean? Like, these network effects are compounding, and this is the new and better system. And so the more irrelevant it becomes, the more relevant Bitcoin becomes, and like, it's just better for everyone involved.
Yeah, the so center, it's like
the one center side of the scale. Hold.
What's that, like, sorry? It's like a poem by Yeats, and the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. It's associated with the World War, but or World War One, I think. But like, it's the center cannot hold. The more bloat in the fiat system, the more things are liable to fall apart. And yeah, it cannot hold.
I kind of I view it as like parasitism rather than elitism, because as like Svetsky depicts, there's nothing elite about them.
They're high-level parasites.
It's just like a parasite. Yeah, 100%. On a host, on a productive host, where it's like they violently steal and in such a sinister manner more and more until eventually they can no longer steal more of the host without killing it. And that's when times become turbulent. But that's why these tools evolve in order to help the host get rid of the parasite. And that's what these cycles, that's what the fourth turning, that's what strong men creating hard times, that's what it's all about, is just getting rid of the host. And that is analogous to just being able to say no.
So think about how much value Augustus Carson's has consumed. Like, he's a pretty big parasite. Imagine him on your body somewhere.
Bro, you would die so quickly.
Oh, man, you'd be squished. Dead. Suffocating. Maybe not suffocated, but certainly suffocating.
Yep. Fast. That's why the top down model's failing. It's because it's so heavy at the top.
Yeah. Cause that motherfucker's on top. And he's as heavy as it gets. God damn it.
But exactly right.
Kiwi, this has been awesome, Rip. I always love my chats with you, my friend, and I just cannot thank you enough again for sharing your finite energy and scarce time with me on Discovering Bitcoin.
D, you are very welcome. I appreciate the opportunity to come and share this with you. And likewise, I always enjoy our conversations, brother, and I look forward to chatting again soon. I'm